Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Hey, Power Athlete Nation, strap in. We got a powerful podcast today with Dr. Julia DeGangi. She's a neuropsychologist, author, and speaker, and she's an expert in the connection between our brains, our emotions, and our relationships. She works in clinical practice teaching her patients how to harness the power of the brain to lead more satisfying and emotionally intelligent lives. She has a new book coming out, Energy Rising. I was able to score an advanced copy, and I can tell you it's a powerful book. It goes through how to harness the power of the brain to lead to more satisfying and emotionally intelligent life. I could tell within the first minute of our interactions before we hit play that she has a PhD with dealing with monkeys like me. We went from having an interesting interaction where I felt like I was interviewing her on the podcast to me all of a sudden being on the couch and her doing her clinical analysis of me. I'm a little nervous to reach back out and hear what she has to say, but I'll connect back with her. I want you guys to keep an eye out for Energy Rising and, more important, plug in for Dr. Julia DeGangi.
So where'd, just some origin story. Where'd you grow up? How'd you get into this? And yeah, I mean, obviously you're a, Harvard medically trained professor and neuropsychologist. So it's, where'd you grow up? How'd you get into this?
So I am a neuropsychologist, which means I'm a clinical psychologist with specialized expertise in the brain. And I never thought I was going to be a psychologist. So grew up in Chicago, and I kind of come from a lineage of psychologists. So my dad's a psychologist, and he focuses on addiction. And there was a lot of emotion in my house, for better and for worse. So I always thought psychology was my dad's thing. My dad is a phenomenal storyteller. So he would always tell really interesting stories about human behavior. My brother is disabled. And my mother worked with immigrants for her whole career. So there was always kind of this very real investment in people. There was always a real investment in, I think, people, diversity. And then there was a real investment in suffering. I'm not exactly sure why, but I knew at a very early age, other people's suffering was my business.
Wow.
So I was really interested in people and their stories and just never thought I'd become a psychologist. So I worked in politics. I actually worked at the White House. I worked on several US presidential campaigns. And then I wanted to continue that kind of advocacy work. And so I started doing international humanitarian aid. So I did work in some UN declared disaster zones. Basically, I was working with really traumatized populations all around the globe. And even if you think about politics, like when people are talking, what they're talking about is really sort of like these things that are core to psychological well-being, healthcare, safe schools, being able to provide for their family. So the thing that actually struck me that I started to think was so interesting is like, here I am in these wildly diverse places. So I'm in Chicago, I'm in Abuja, Nigeria, I'm in Detroit, I'm in Nairobi, Kenya, I'm in Argentina. And no matter where I went on the planet, loss always looked like loss. Grief always looked like grief. greed always looked like greed, hope always looked like hope. And so I became very interested in how it could be that on some level there can be so much difference, but our basically our bodies are sort of reacting in very similar ways. So I actually decided to go back to school and I became a neuropsychologist. So I was very interested in both the scientific study of trauma and resilience. And I now talk about my work as the relationship between your brain, emotional pain, and emotional power.
Wow. Aren't they interlinked? I mean, you know, we had Angela Duckworth on the podcast with her book Grit, and there feels like there's this direct correlation between, you know, early exposure to, you know, hardship and adversity as a driving factor for success later in life.
So are you asking me, are pain and power related?
Yeah.
Is that absolutely. So yeah. I think that they are two sides of the same coin, right? It's like, you cannot have the night without the day. You can't have the up without the down. So, you know, I wrote this book, Energy Rising, and the reason I wrote it, and, you know, I like to say I'm a Midwest academic who likes to go to two parties a year. And the rest of the time, I like to kind of spend alone in my office thinking and sort of taking care of my patients. So I never even thought that I would sort of do such a public facing thing. But to be able to tell this story of human pain and human power, kind of human redemption after pain, was just so moving to me. So the premise of the book is really this idea that everything we want in this lifetime is on the other side of the feelings we keep telling ourselves we can't feel. You want more self-confidence? You have to be able to come into a new relationship with the energy of doubt. You want more peace? You must be able to come into a new relationship with the energy of uncertainty. You want more intimacy or more connection? You're going to have a new relationship with rejection. So where we are in our lives is always constrained by the feelings we think we can't feel. And I think to be able to have this conversation with you is so, I think, first of all, I'm very grateful. I think these are very transformative conversations, because I think oftentimes when we feel bad feelings in our body, anxiety, stress, inadequacy, we think that's a sign we should quit. Oh God, that's dangerous. Don't do it. Oh my God, that's dangerous. Don't speak up. Oh my God. But oftentimes it's that sensation, that's the very evidence that you should continue, because it's the clearest evidence that you're actually getting more emotionally strong, more emotionally powerful.
Do you feel that emotions are like a superpower? I always viewed kind of emotion as a bit of a weakness. I don't know if you know my history, but I played in the NFL for 10 years. And as a, you know, starter in the NFL, I saw guys get, you know, two up, two down. And I looked at, especially for playing football, very even keel, you know, calm, cool, and collected as being more beneficial. And that for me personally, managing my emotions, especially in stressful situations, was what I felt was my superpower. And I used to watch guys like make a mistake and all of a sudden go in the tank and not be able to do anything. I watched guys have a great play and all of a sudden, you know, they couldn't come back and replicate. Whereas I always felt that calm and stool and or calm, collected, and steady was extremely beneficial. And the only problem with that is then I carried that into my own personal life. And mm-hmm. then you're just kind of mm-hmm. like this. And it's difficult with relationships. It's difficult in a lot of things. And since, you know, getting married and becoming a father, and now I have, you know, three kids, I've had to like almost rekindle some of that emotion, because the worst thing you can be as a father of daughters is a just baseline blah.
Now, can I ask you a question? Were you
sure.
always that idea of like calm, cool, and collected? Was that always your disposition? Like even as a child, were you kind of like that, or is this something you really worked on?
I think it was probably something that I, at least when I asked my brother about it, he was like, you've always been the same way. Okay. I don't get rattled. It's the same. If I'm driving a car at 200 miles an hour, it's the same as if I'm driving a car at 70, and I've driven a car at 200 miles an hour. And so I'm not just saying that as a, you know, analogy, but, I have never, really had get rattled in stressful situations. I can stand up and speak in front of, you know, hundreds or thousands of people and don't really, you know, have a huge emotional, like, oh my God, I'm going to, you know, fear and doubt. I always had confidence in my ability to execute because I was always able to. And I always looked at too much emotion. I just saw guys take big roller coasters, and that kind of cool, calm, and collected, and my ability to stay, I guess, cool under pressure. I recently was working with a group that does brain scans for EEGs, and they were just in town. And as the guy rescanned my brain, he was showing me, he's like, you know, there's this little bump at the end. And that's the part that we see where people are able to manage this kind of, I guess, stressful situations with a cool way. And it's just, I always view that more as a bit of my superpower. And for what's been kind of fascinating is I always viewed people that were highly emotional with all these doubts and all this, you know, like almost looked like a spin cycle going on, almost as a sign of weakness. And since retiring from the NFL, realizing that that was probably a protective mechanism that allowed me to do my job. But then since getting out and kind of getting back, you know, and you know, being a professional athlete, you kind of live within this bubble. I mean, we kind of view everything as an ivory tower where, you know, all your friends are professional athletes and you live in the NFL and, you know, you think everybody drives nice cars and is 6'5" and just kind of, and then you get out and you realize the rest of the world isn't like this. But just seeing like the emotion, and especially having kids and, you know, being married, being emotionless and disconnected in that kind of way and being very cool, calm and collected, isn't very good in terms of being married and especially, you know, raising kids.
Sure. So I have one other question, John, and I promise not to like keep asking questions. But I am
totally fine because I want to ask you a ton of questions. So I figure.
Okay, great. I love the exchange.
I figure I can be your therapist. You can be mine. It's probably what you do.
I love that. Yeah. We'll both feel lighter at the end of this.
Yeah. 100%.
Okay. So how you kind of said you had this more restricted emotional range, you kind of called it cool, calm and collected. I think we all know what that means. You also though feel, I thought your example of the car was great. Where whether you're going 20 miles an hour or 200 miles an hour kind of feels the same. Is it accurate then to say that you don't really get ecstatic? You don't have like these really profound moments of happiness. You don't get too high either.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. So the thing about emotion is it's really on this kind of seesaw. So the more pain we feel, the more joy we're able to feel, the more, so there's a range. It doesn't mean every time you feel happy, you're going to feel a commensurate amount of sadness, for example, but you're making a really good point that I think is going to be pretty powerful for your listeners, which is that the emotional range, the amount of light comes with a commensurate amount of ability to feel dark. I have a massive emotional range.
No.
Massive.
I do not believe that at all.
True. Did you peg me for it right at the beginning?
Yeah, you came in and so I've done 735 podcasts. You've been doing this for 10 years. The best podcasts are usually when I'm sitting across from the people, just because, you know, there's so many more physical cues that you can take, and especially having a conversation. And I always felt that for the most part, when you do a Zoom, like maybe 50%, 80%, you know, 20%, like different things. And a lot of people are not very skilled at doing the Zoom interview. You, on the other hand, I feel like you're sitting in front of me. So, you know, there's emotion on your face, like you smiled it, like there's a lot of tells going on, you know, having done this for a number of years. Some people just sit there and it might as well be like, you know, one of those cartoons where the face doesn't move and then just like they like, you know, basically put the lips over and they move. A lot of people give zero I'm just kind of dropping the word, but like the subliminal, you know, facial expressions, it just, for the most part, like I was making the joke that when we would do it without the Zoom or without the video and there was just audio, I was like convinced that people were just sitting there with no pants on, eating their breakfast, talking. And it was just like, man, like I need something more if we're going to continue to do this. And, you know, it's not like we get the opportunity to fly people in very often, even though we do. But, you know, sometimes we have to do them like this. And to have people that are pretty skilled at one, and, you know, you seem, you know, doctor of emotion, probably pretty good at this.
Yeah. So, you know, and it used to be like it's really interesting because it used to be a big secret of mine. And I think to you, the reason is exactly your point. I think there's kind of this very pervasive cultural story that emotions are a form of weakness.
Yeah.
The problem with this is neurologically, it makes no damn sense. So emotions, if you really understand how the brain works, are the Google Maps of your life. So it is emotions that are telling you, at the next intersection, please turn left and exit the relationship. At the next intersection, please turn right and get a new damn job. And so what happens is, instead of paying attention to this, and if you think about what's actually happening, it gives me chills every time I think about it. It is, your emotions are these incredible neuroelectrical signals that your brain is sending through your nervous system to your body that are telling you how you subsequently should behave. So what happens to a lot of us is we start to say, not only am I'm not going to listen to the intelligent guidance system of my brain at this intersection, I'm not going to pay attention to this damn thing for the next 40 years of my life.
Mm. Yeah.
And there's a real consequence of that. Okay. We wake up and we have this sense of like, our lives don't belong to us. We almost kind of feel dissociated from them. Like people will talk to me about feeling numb. They'll talk to me about kind of looking around like, is this all there is? I got to do this shit for another. You see what I'm saying? So yeah. It's like, well, why would that happen? And I think, you know, people will come to me all the time and say, what is power? Now they don't say power. They'll usually say things like happiness or contentment or confidence or connection. But in my mind, that is the exact definition of power. How do we access in this lifetime what we really want to access? Well, you have to understand that your brain has three engines, okay? There's an engine of thinking, there's an engine of behaving, and there's an engine of feeling. What happens, I would tell you, almost all of our pain comes in what I'm about to say here, is imagine these engines are really moving you through space and time. This is not metaphorical. This is actually neurobiological. So imagine I was going to make a car. You just gave this example of this car that goes 200 miles an hour. And I was like, hey, John, I'm going to make this amazing car. I'm going to put a ton of effort into it. And I'm going to have three engines, except two engines are going to drive in one direction. And then I'm going to have one engine driving in the exact opposite direction. You'd be like, that is you definitely don't need to be a car engineer because that's the dumbest idea, right?
Yeah.
But if you think about how a lot of us are living our lives, is we're feeling in one direction and then we are behaving in the exact opposite direction. So let me give you some examples. This relationship doesn't feel good to me. It's not feeling good. It's not just not feeling good on Thursday. It hasn't been feeling good for months, years, or even decades. What do I do? So I'm feeling like this isn't working. What do? I stay. I'm feeling exhausted. I'm working too much. My body needs rest. What do? I overwork. I'm feeling like I want to speak up. I want to express something. I want to have a difficult conversation. I want to create something. What do? I keep my mouth shut. In each of those moments, I have quite literally divided my energy of behaving from my energy of feeling. And people love to say emotions are so confusing. Emotions are not confusing. They are the universal language of human beings everywhere on the planet. Okay. What the logical consequence of me spending 5 years, 10 years, 15 years ignoring these neurobiological messengers, these little electrical impulses that are trying to guide me in a way that's more aligned with what I actually want, is things like boredom, burnout, exhaustion, numbness, depression. I mean, there's a very real consequence of the continuous rejection of emotion.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market.
We've built our online training business by partnering with Train Heroic and helping us deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training.
And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best tech and training, go to trainheroic.co/powerathletehq. And now back to the show.
Man, that's a lot to unpack. For me, this is kind of fascinating. And I feel like a lot of this work for me has happened later in life, just because, you know, growing up, you know, as a little boy, you know, I was born in 76. So growing up in the 70s and 80s, it was like handshake father. Like I didn't hug my dad until I was probably 18 years old when I came home from college, and it made him uncomfortable. So like, you know, the whole thing of like, you know, be a man, don't cry, little boys, you know, like almost like a emotion is weakness. Girls are emotional, little boys aren't, you know, and I feel that that was the time I was raised in. And, you know, my dad obviously was raised in that too. And, you know, when I went to go play football, I viewed a lot of like the emotion guys got too high, too low. I just looked at it like, hey, You know, we can go walk out and run out in front of 100,000 people, and obviously there's nervous energy, but my heart rate never raised. I could see everything. I just never really got wrapped up in the emotion. And having thought about it since I retired, I think part of it had to do with I really enjoyed playing and I loved the competition aspect. I could care less about the football aspect. I just wanted to go one-on-one fist fight somebody for 3 hours. And I got to know exactly how good or bad I was with the toughest people every Sunday in front of millions of people.
Wait, say more about what do you mean when you say you could care less about football? Explain more about that.
I didn't really care about the sport, like, you know, the touchdowns and all the, you know, other stuff. I just liked the one-on-one combat. I played offensive line. I played guard and tackle. I just got to go one-on-one and basically fight a dude, prevent him from doing what he wants to in front of millions of people like a gladiator. I really viewed myself more, not as a football player, but almost a master of violence. And the violence did not affect me. You know, watch other people like, oh, you know, violent situations or emotion, and all of a sudden they're up. And I've seen people get into fights and cry. For some reason, when the violence got turned up and the draw and all that got turned up, I had never felt more relaxed and more calm, and everything felt more clear. It's almost like the more chaos there is, the more clarity I would have. Mm-hmm. And it was a very comforting thing to be like, oh man, like the whole world's ending and like everything seems very clear. And when I retired from the NFL, I was put in a brain study for Dr. Amen, and they did all these scans and mapping. And the part of my brain that was actually a little squished and a little messed up was over here on the left frontal lobe. And as I went to go meet with Dr. Amen and they were presenting this, they were like, you know, we went through all these scans. We have all this information. There's a CT scan and an MRI, and they did all this. He's like, you know, the good news and the bad news. I was like, well, let me give me the good news first. He said, of all the people we tested, cognitively, you were the smartest. You had the highest IQ, had the best retention, all these other things. You were off the charts. But the part of your brain that's damaged was over here in your left frontal lobe, and that deals with sympathy and empathy. And when we were going through a lot of the testing and a lot of the cognitive stuff, your emotional intelligence was very, very low. And I was like, emotional, all right, well, is emotion necessarily a good thing? And so when he told me I had low emotional intelligence, you know, and then I laughed and I was like, hey, this is not bad news, but can I get a doctor's note? Because there's no way my mom and my wife are going to believe that I'm an insensitive asshole. But now that I have a doctor's note and a proof, it's going to help. But then I ended up, my wife ended up getting pregnant. We ended up having twin girls. And I realized that whatever wiring and whatever programming or software I was working with was not going to benefit me as a father of daughters.
In that system. Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. especially being a good husband. So it kind of started me on this kind of journey. And, you know, here I am, you know, 10 plus years later. And I went and got re-scanned yesterday. And all of the damage in the frontal lobe is all healed itself. And I'm much better today, you know, and it's just by doing this work and realizing that because I viewed emotion a lot as a weakness, which is why, you know, when, you know, your book was coming out and we kind of connected, I was like, wow, this is personally, I mean, selfishly, I want to have the conversation because I'm in this constant evolution. I mean, the podcast we do, but selfishly, it's about creating a, you know, genealogy, a structure, and really just, you know, having interesting conversations, but selfishly, for me to, you know, continue to work on myself.
Okay. So I have so many questions. The first is, you said something really interesting when you were on the field and the chaos would just really kind of escalate. That was the moment when you felt kind of the calmest.
Yeah.
Does that happen outside of a football context? So if there's chaos in your home or there's chaos, like, do you generally feel more centered in chaos?
Not really.
Okay. So there's something unique about just the football context.
Yeah. And it probably has to do with, you know, I mean, like, you know, I imagine the gladiators running into the Coliseum probably felt the same way. You know, I mean, like I have, you know, my daughters are almost 12 now, and like, I don't know if you have kids, but the amount of mess that
I
they
do.
Make,
I have two little.
Okay. Yeah. The amount of mess they make on a daily basis almost gives me anxiety. I'm like, how did you guys make this big a mess this quickly? So I like everything to be pretty clean and neat, even though I'm not like a OCD neat freak. Like, just pick your stuff up. And so it's like in the morning they leave, it's like a bomb goes off. And they're like,
I know, you know, every morning. I'm like, does that many Cheerios get on the ceiling? Yeah, like, I can't even make the physics of it work.
I'm like, my daughter, like, you know, we got to leave school at 8, and she comes like walking in like with a toothbrush at like 8:06, and I'm like, did you hear mom honking? She's like, yeah, I'm just brushing. I'm like, So I don't appreciate like the chaos or the drama, or like, you know, I'm not like picking fights with my wife and my family to somehow feel something, but I definitely know that like standing up and presenting in front of a large group of people, or, you know, what I was able to do, I do some combatives and some jujitsu and some other things, but like, I know that in those stressful physical situations that are combative, I feel extremely relaxed. And I really like that. I remember my wife, you know, I hadn't done anything, but I lift weights and I train, and she's like, you need to go out and do something that's like, you know, like you need to go out and like, you know, like, and I boxed and I fought, and just all of these things are all so intrinsic to me that I need that form of physical kind of combatives. And I really love playing the NFL for that. And, you know, couldn't care less about, you know, the touchdowns of the glory and everything. It was all just about, you know, putting on our game unis and basically one-on-one fist fighting a dude for 3 hours. That was it. And just managing the violence and like, you know, when people would, you know, aggression and all, I loved it. I would laugh. Like when people get real angry or aggressive and put myself in aggressive, you know, where you're out and somebody acts, or, you know, you have people with road rage, I think it's hysterical. And I probably start giggling a little bit because I'm like, oh man, is this going to happen? Like, are these people crazy? What's going to go on? And when that happens,
do you get anxious? So you had said like, do you experience that as an emotion?
I don't really ever feel anxious about anything. The only anxiousness I ever feel has to do more with what I call toxic energy vampires, or people that I'm around that, one, you know, and I'm sure you've worked with employees or different people you've worked with that are like just bad energy. And like, that's the only thing that makes me a little anxious, is when I know I have to deal with somebody that, is, you know, either not confident in what they're doing, is nefarious, or just really just a shitty person for me to be around. I like confident people that can speak their mind, that know what they want to do. I don't like, just emotionless kind of nefarious people that are just kind of fighting for their little piece. I want to be around people that are intelligent, that have something to say, that can carry a conversation and, you know, force me to think outside the box, or at least push me mentally or emotionally. You know, being around people that just, you know, are just like blank screens that are, you know, like that, those people make me anxious. I don't want to be around dull people. I want to be around intelligent people that, you know, fire and have good conversations.
And then do you feel fear?
No, I don't. The only time I've really ever felt a feeling of fear had to do more in relationship to my kids. So about in October this year, my daughter got attacked by our neighbor's dog, and it was pretty gnarly. And like, it's probably one of the first times I've ever, because I don't feel fear for myself. I've never been in a situation where I've ever feared for my life. You know, and I've been in a lot of situations. I don't necessarily feel fear as an emotion for me, but I did and feel it for my kids. I think I'm more fearful for my kids, or maybe my wife, or those around me. Mm-hmm. But for myself, no. I mean, if the end of the world comes and a big asteroid's coming, I lived a great life. If everything melted down and social services, and we ended up in some Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, I'd figure that out too. So, I don't like fear and angst and all these other things that probably, you know, oh, like I could never do that. You know, what if people laugh at me? Like, I have zero, like that doesn't even equate in my mind.
Okay. Really? I have one other question. I'm going to tell you why, like, cause anxiety, fear, and the next one, do you ever feel angry? Like, is anger an emotion you know, yeah, or not really?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. But it has to do more with, people that are disingenuous, or people that I think that there should be like a basic, you know, code of how you should treat people, and more importantly, like how you should act. Like, you should treat people well. You should be forthright and honest. Like, you know, don't steal. Don't be nefarious. You know, do a good job. I mean, we have some pillars in my community, or in my company, which is like, don't steal. Right. Be a good person. Do what you say you're going to do, and don't do nothing. As long as you adhere to those four things, we're fine. I'm going to get pissed if I feel you're nefarious, if you're lazy and you're stealing from me, or if you are acting in a way that potentially is like negative and stifling to other people within an environment. Like, that shit pisses me off, because I probably feel defensive for them because I see it, and don't be like that. If you're, I've come to the, you know, maybe this is kind of old school, but, you know, I think that there's certain ideals that men should adhere to. And I feel like there's a, you know, my mom told me a funny story once. She said, be nervous of old men that start acting like old women. And, you know, it was just kind of an interesting statement. And I was like, what do you mean like old women? She's like, you know, ratty, you know, sitting around like a sewing circle stuff, petty type stuff. And, you know, I feel like men act like that more and more. And so I've tried to strive to be around people that are, you know, do what they say, what they're going to do, hardworking, honest, and actually their word means something. And when I'm around people like that, I get pissed because I think people should hold themselves to a higher standard. The one thing I did enjoy about the NFL, it was extremely basic, right? You go out there and the wins and losses are very simple. They're on camera. We can watch them. We know exactly what happened. It's all out there. There's nothing behind the, you know, all the other behind the curtain stuff I didn't care for, but I liked the transparency of what happened on the field. And I wish we could have more of that transparency within life and within daily meetings. And so I tend to surround myself with people like that. And if somebody's like that, that might give me anxiety or a little bit of like angst to be around being like, something's wrong with this dude. And I don't know what it is, but I don't know necessarily. But I also have realized something, that I'm a process driven person, not an outcome driven person. So when you're a process driven person, I feel that there's always going to be bumps in the road. And I have this blind faith that like I can mentor somebody across the finish line, that if I have enough opportunity to put them into the process. We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Power Athlete delivers battle-tested performance programming for every kind of athlete. So do you want to go from average Joe to MVP? Then dominate with Field Strong. Get stacked and jacked with Jack Street. Hustle in life and still build muscle with Grindstone. Fear no opponent with Dragon Slayer. Be harder than coffin nails with Hammer. Max out minimal equipment with Lean Enable. Or unlock those newbie gains with Bedrock. Get over to powerathletehq.com/training and choose your 7-day free trial right here, right now. Get lifting, get training, get in shape, all while listening to the rest of this show.
That makes a lot of sense. So you're saying a lot of things that are making me think a lot of things. So let me say a couple of things that I think are might be useful at this point. So it's interesting to me that you said the one I heard you basically kind of, I'm going to distill this down, but the people that are really triggers for me are people that I can't trust, that maybe say one thing or do another or pretend like they're going to engage and then don't engage.
Yes.
So obviously people that we can't trust are dangerous to us. Now, does that mean they're going to kill us? No, but like we have goals in our life. And when people thwart them, that's going to activate the threat networks in our brain. One of the things you're actually saying though, and so I, as a trauma expert, have worked with excruciating human emotions. So I've worked with rage, betrayal, despondency. I would suggest to you that one of the most difficult human emotions is emotions that we don't actually talk about all the time. The emotion I'm thinking of is the emotion of confusion. Hmm. Confusion can be debilitating to the brain. So to understand this, you have to understand what the machinery of the brain is. You know, it sometimes tickles me or frustrates me depending on my mood. It's like we are paying more attention on how to operate ChatGPT and our cell phones than we pay attention to the intelligent operation of our own brains and nervous systems.
Yeah.
The brain is the most powerful machine you will ever own. And there's, you know, the reason I wrote Energy Rising is it's kind of a user's manual for how to use your brain powerfully. So your brain is best thought of as a prediction machine. Okay. So it's moving you through your life going apple, 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 fill in the blank, apple. So when I get to a situation in my life that I can't make sense of, the person saying they're doing X, but it doesn't actually look like they're doing X. You said you were going to do Y, but you're not doing Y.
Yeah.
What happens is the brain gets to a point and it's like, I need the function of the brain is to predict patterns. So you can see that a very difficult thing for the brain to do as an organ is I get to a blank and now I have to go, wait, is it an apple or is it a watermelon or is it a tangerine? So what happens 99 times out of 100 is if I don't have clear information, the brain cannot sit with an open blank. So my brain is automatically going to close the pattern, and it's going to close the pattern in the most protective way. What does the most protective way almost always look like? Activation of threat networks, which leads to emotions like fear or anger. So it's like we've all had this situation. It's like someone doesn't text us back and they should have texted us back. And like five hours later, we think they hate us or we've done something to insult them. It's like Maybe they're just busy, right? Do you see how the brain really can't sit with uncertainty? So it's going to make up an answer. And the answer, if we don't understand what the brain is doing, is almost always, paradoxically enough, going to weaken us. Oh, they're mad at us.
I don't, if somebody doesn't text me back, I assume that's their issue. I don't sit there and be like, oh my God, they didn't hit me back. Like I was texting with a buddy of mine. My buddy Shanji is a jiu-jitsu guy, and we were just basically talking trash. And he said something to me, and I totally smoked him, and he didn't respond. And I was like, yes. And I know when I see him, he's going to try to choke me out, and he's going to be mad about it because he stews on things. And it's funny. And I do that to kind of bait him a little bit. But for the most part, like if somebody doesn't hit me back on something, like that's on them. I'm always amazed that people internalize like their emotion, like, oh my God, this person doesn't like me. And I'm like, okay, so how are you influencing that? Like, how can you control somebody else's emotion? Like, they're either going to like, and I told my kids, people are going to like you and they're going to dislike you through life. Like, what you have to do is find the people that like you and like have good relationships with those people. Like, you're never going to convince. Have you ever won an argument on the internet? Have you ever like been on the internet, engaged with somebody and convinced them where they're like, you know what? I can see your point of view. You're right. It's never happened. Actually, one time it happened to me on the internet. I just feel that. And I really just kind of chalk this up that I feel a lot of people are dealing with bad software. I mean, we deal on the hardware side. I train athletes. I educate coaches. I give them information and programs. And we've developed a training system based off my NFL experience and all the stuff that I've done to help people be better versions of themselves and foster and develop athleticism. But that's what I do in terms of the hardware side. The software side, I just feel that a lot of people are, you know, either emotionally broken, have never achieved what they've wanted to, or have never really ever been tested to the point where they know if they're going to actually answer the bell and do what they need to do. And for me, like I've been battle tested and proven. I've done it on the highest level and, you know, converted and done all of these things. So confidence is with me. And so I think I get a little disappointed where I meet people that are so fearful and I'm like, what's the worst? You fail and we learn something? Like I weld and I fabricate and I build stuff. A lot of times I don't know the best way to do it. And so if I reach out to a friend or somebody that knows more, I'm humble enough. I've always felt too, like asking for help is a superpower. If I don't know something, I'm more than happy to ask somebody for help. And I don't need to be the expert. My ego doesn't need to be stroked. I like the Bruce Lee, empty your cup. Like I'm happy to empty my cup. If you have more knowledge, I'm happy to take it. And you know what? And I'll be more the first person to be like, I learned this from this person. I don't need this credit. And, you know, with everything I do, I feel that there's a learning process and that you have to go through this like point of, you know, unconscious incompetence and move to, you know, conscious incompetent or sorry, competence unconsciously, right? I mean, all these things, like everything's about this journey and this learning piece. And what I'm constantly amazed for is people that won't ask for help, people that just like shut down and don't have the ability to at least verbalize something. And so I feel that asking for help and being able to like reach out and, you know, talk about things or more importantly, be honest with yourself and those around you. I have no ego to protect and it's probably because I've accomplished a lot in my life. And I did that with, you know, like, so it's just kind of a confusing when I run into people all the time or, you know, people work for you or, you know, different interactions where you see people that have this immense amount of fear. And I'm like, I'm always amazed that they're so guarded with this stuff. Does that make sense a little bit?
I mean, I hear your experience, but I think plenty of people's experience is not that. So I think if we're going to lead them to kind of this more powerful version of themselves, we have to understand how the emotional energy is working. And I think when people lock up or when people can't speak up, that line, to go back to what I said at the beginning of our conversation, it's always emotional. Now, oftentimes it is catastrophic. It's something, and when they start to even verbalize it, they start to say like, this is a little bit ridiculous. In fact, part of the reason we think that the neuroscientific reason we think talk therapy works is because where emotions kind of are stored in the brain and where linear language works in the brain, they're fairly discrete regions. So when I have to take a sensation like fear or nervousness or uncertainty, because most people, you know, we have plenty of evidence, most people do not like uncertainty. right? So you even like, if you think back to COVID, plenty of people were saying, I wish I could just get COVID already and get it over with. So it's like, we would rather get physically ill than sit with, now maybe you're not like that, but
no,
I think people.
Yeah, no, well, one, I never got COVID. And I went out and I tried to get it. Like I was around people where I was like, man, maybe I'll get it too. And I still have never got it. But the uncertainty, and I've never been fearful of change. You know, when we were in California, we unsolicited offer on our home, sold our house, guy showed up, knocked on the door, you know, paid us, you know, seven figures more than what we paid for the home. We were out 30 days, came out here to Austin, bought a ranch. Started building this stuff. I mean, I have never sat there and thought, maybe I can't do that. Like it's just never dawned on my mind. Like I can, one, there's YouTube, and two, I can ask for help, and three, I'm pretty handy. And it doesn't matter what it is. I've just never felt doubt in who I am. And it's probably,
but I think too, it's like, isn't part of your work. So if you're saying, it sounds like you obviously draw on a tremendous wealth of experience and expertise. And part of what you're doing right now is sort of paying it forward, mentoring people. Is that right?
100%.
So I think though, you know, you mentioned this, you use this distinction of like, I'm in the hardware and then there's software. I think that's a great analogy. If we're really thinking about how to strengthen software, the software lies in the emotional energy. The software lies in my ability to feel. And what's very interesting to me, and I think this analog will really resonate, is no one is ever confused about how to get physically stronger, right? So if I can lift 5 pounds on a dumbbell today, the only way I'm going to get stronger is if tomorrow I go to the gym and try to lift 15 pounds.
Hold on, Doc. You just melted the entire internet, because what you said is basically the linear progression, which is how you get people stronger. I have to do a little bit more tomorrow than what I did the day before. And this is like the analogy for life. I you can't see it over here, but one of the branding mantras for our company is called Move the Dirt. And it was an analogy I gave about training, which is like, imagine training in life is like a big pile of dirt. I just have to move dirt every single day from one pile to the other side to continue. And some days I get a shovel, some days I get a spoon, but as long as I move dirt, I'm getting, you know, towards my pile. And so what you just said, there are literally hundreds, or there's millions of people on the internet that haven't figured that out and still argue on this deal, where it's like, you have to do a little bit more. What you did yesterday won't get you there. I mean, but the same thing is true for education. Same is true for, you know, just about everything, that people get to a point where they figure like, this is enough load, and they don't know how to progress. And only adding a little more load or a little more intensity, whatever it is the only way you progress.
And I think too, I think people get to choose. I'm very deep into empowerment. I think this is really the only way out of a lot of the messes we get in, which is people are the ultimate authority of their own lives. Okay. So I get to decide, this is enough load for me emotionally, educationally, physically. But what I want for people is just to understand the mechanism behind that. In other words, like, I will never in my life train for an Ironman, and I'm okay with that. Right. But I'm not confused.
Me too. I'll never do an Ironman. We cannot do them together.
But my point here is like, I'm not confused. Right. So I'm really choosing from a place of understanding and knowledge. So I think what happens with emotions that is kind of singular is we have sensations in our body. And it sounds like you have less than maybe the average person, but the nervous system is giving you like, this is dangerous, or don't do this, or tread lightly, or be a little bit anxious. So a lot of times we'll get those cues in the body and we'll think it's evidence to stop pursuit of the thing we actually want.
No, if anything that we learned from the 80s and 90s video games is wherever the bad guys are, that's the way you go. You know, if you think you got on the first person shooter, like Halo type games, you usually go wherever the bad guys are. If the bad guys are coming this way, this is the direction you go. And I got that from Ali G, but I've kind of taken that as a deal. Wherever there is the, you know, the most hardship, or the bad guys, or there seems to be the most friction, that tends to be the direction that's easiest or the best way to go. Would you say? Correct?
Well, say a little bit more why you can use your video. I'm not a gamer. So say a little bit more about the analogy.
Why
do you go in the direction of the bad guys?
Well, it feels like wherever like the biggest opportunity comes, like I'm sure like, okay, hey, like, this scares me a little bit, or, you know, I'm nervous to do this. I feel that whatever you're nervous or, you know, scared to do, that's the direction you should probably go. Like I meet people all the time where I was a rhetoric major in college, got my master's in education and was, you know, prepping to go to law school, and then got drafted and played 10 years in the NFL. And then after I got done, I got headhunted to work for CrossFit, traveled and taught hundreds of seminars around the globe. And people ask me all the time, like, when you went to go teach the first seminar, I was like, I stood up in front of 50 people and presented my information. Well, were you nervous to get up in front of those people? I'm like, no, they were there to hear me speak. Like, I was the expert giving them the information. Why would I be nervous? And I just, those pieces of, you know, playing in front of people and doing all this, like, that stuff never really rattled me. I always imagine people in their mind imagine things to be a million times worse than they really are. You know, like all of a sudden, you know, you have a guy, you know, recently one of our coaches, we had a kind of a like a cold plunge kind of hot, and one of our coaches, Chris Bean, who's a incredibly interesting and like really a good dude, he was nervous about taking his shirt off. And he was like building up all this emotion. And then finally somebody was like, just get in the cold tub. And he did. And he wrote like a really nice piece about it. And he's like, I was super nervous and this, and he did it. And I was like, you know what? As I was reading his, the post that he put out, I was like, what you imagine in your mind is a million times worse. Nobody even noticed. But yet you're like imagining that all these people, you know, and it's just, I feel that people create their own prisons and imagine everything to be so much worse. Like you said, the person doesn't text you back. Oh, they don't like me. Maybe their phone just ran out of charge.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that we are so self-sabotaging, and sometimes the emotions get the worst of us. When if we just looked at it from like a little bit different point of view.
Or right, but that doesn't work. So you're being very logical about this, but for people who have, so it sounds like we all have different dispositions, right? We all are taller. Some of us are shorter. Some of us enjoy math more. Some of us enjoy history more, whatever. Right.
Yeah. Nobody likes geometry. So
if you're saying to someone, because a lot of times what's going to happen overwhelmingly is people already know this. So you're saying to somebody, the person, let's go back to the texting example, just because it's a low hanging fruit. The person probably does not actually hate me and never wants to speak to me ever. So I already actually know that. You see, so there's two processes that can happen simultaneously. It's like, I kind of rationally understand this, but I'm also emotionally feeling a lot of things. What happens to a lot of people is, I want you to think of, there's two runners in your brain. Okay. So there's a thinking runner and there's an emotional runner. We know that the healthiest, strongest, most powerful brain is a brain that is integrated, meaning I'm thinking and I'm feeling in tandem. If I'm thinking too much and not feeling it, this kind of goes back to what you were saying at the beginning. I think people initially thought that that was going to be a good way to live. We're now very clear it's not, right?
No.
So if you think about wellness, it's about integration.
Yeah.
What happens to a lot of people is the opposite, is like, I'm thinking and feeling until you trigger me. What, somebody cuts me off at a stop sign, and now my emotional runner takes off. Now I'm pissed for the rest of the night. I'm swearing at him. My kids are in my car. In other words, I've really lost my emotional center. So it's going to take a while for that thinking runner to kind of catch up to my emotional runner. And then oftentimes when that happens, a lot of us feel things like, well, shit, I really overreacted. I embarrassed myself. Now I have to sit with shame. Now I have to apologize to my children for swearing. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So for a lot of people, they can know something and feel something different, but until they're understanding how to work with that emotional energy in their body, thinking alone is not the fix.
Gotcha.
You can't just think yourself out of that. Now, if you have a different disposition, meaning you just already sort of natively have a different relationship with affect, emotion, that's great. But for people who have this other disposition, there needs to be a way to train on the emotional system.
Do you think things are changing? This is something that, I talk to my daughters constantly about, the interactions, because, this is hilarious, but my daughter was telling me about furries, like people that dress up like animals and go to conventions and, you know, these like.
Didn't know this existed. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So they wear these big costumes, and she was showing me like a video. She's like, Dad, check this out. These people dress up in these like crazy costumes and they go to these like events and this. And I tried to explain it to her that if you isolate yourself on the internet, like you, like I feel that a lot of like weirdness can happen, that in society, when you're around a lot of people, it almost acts like bumper cars. When people get too weird or something strange happens, people kind of like, I don't know. And when you isolate yourself, people tend to go down these little rabbit holes, and then they can find other people that have isolated themselves. And that's where you get some of this weirdness. So I constantly am talking to them about, you know, you guys, you know, it's good to have your friends over. It's good to have interactions. And it's actually, you know, I mean, and COVID really showed us this, that people developed all of these different online interactions, like we're doing Zoom here. And while this is a great interaction, like you, if you were sitting here, it would be a much more rich experience. So I'm constantly in this with like one of her girlfriends. They like Snapchat and they text and they're so excited to see each other. But then like 5 minutes later, they're both on their phones. And I'm like, dude, you've been talking about hanging out with this girl and like you're so excited and you guys have this great relationship. But then I'm seeing you guys sitting over there and you're like on your phones, not interacting. And so I go take the phones and I'm like, you guys need to interact. And it just takes them a little while to like, once you take the phones, to kind of figure out and, you know, kind of how to do this. Whereas we didn't grow up with phones, and you know, I was telling my daughters, we got home, like where we lived was by the bus stop, so everybody walked by our house, and we had a standing pickup basketball game that we played for years. And then people would go home, and we would just get on our bikes, and you'd ride around and find bikes, and then you go to your friends' houses, and that's how you found friends. Like you didn't necessarily get on a phone, nobody made any plans, it just right. Everything was impromptu.
Right.
But now I feel because of, you know, social media or just the phone kind of this digital age, that those days don't really exist like they used to. So just kind of stressing this a little bit, being like, you almost have to be better today and like more like we have to sharpen this earlier because I feel like you're not going to have as many interactions like we used to.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're very clear that the way the phones are designed, they're very, very taxing and very, very addictive to the brain, right? It has a lot to do with the dopamine systems in the brain. You know, I always say attention is the, as a neuropsychologist, I study all these neurocognitive domains, how we think, how we verbally remember, how we visually remember. But the mother of all of your abilities is attention. So if you're not paying attention in the first place, you're not going to solve any problems. You're not going to make any new relationships. You're not even going to remember the thing. In order to even remember something, we have to be attending to it to begin with. So I think, you know, what's happening now, obviously it's the wild, wild west, but what's very interesting to me is like, we have to train the brain. We have to train the brain to pay attention. What's happening to people is they're getting these really, really fragmented attention spans. Like sometimes I'll see people write, I'm not kidding, a paragraph of text on social media. And at the end, they'll say, thank you if you've made it this long.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, that took me less than 3 seconds to read. How could this possibly be shorter? So then you start getting conversations.
Mm-hmm. One of my problems is when people do this, I usually have to cut and paste it and add in the punctuation. I cannot read just like where people do this, like no punctuation, brain dump. And I watch this all the time. Like it's just a thought. And like, I'll literally go back and I have to add punctuation into people's thoughts because it just doesn't make sense to me. I'm so used to reading it. And like the abandonment of grammar kills me on the internet. And that's just probably my own shortcomings, but like it's crazy. Interesting thing, and this is another thing that I wrote down I wanted to talk about. One of the things which has kind of popped up and being over the age of 40, I'm constantly amazed at how lonely men are. And I started researching into like suicide and like the rates of suicide men over the 40 is like astronomical. And as I was going through, and it's kind of a little disconcerting, and there's like, you know, crystallization, lack of neuroplasticity. I mean, you know, feelings of inadequacy, failure, you know, my life is coming to an end and I haven't accomplished what I've done. I've had a bad relationship and people just, you know, are deciding to take the easy way out on that. It feels that this is much more of a problem. And I wonder if it comes back from, you know, men don't do a good job of, you know, starting new relationships and having friends and talking about emotion, or is it something else that's happening?
I think again, so just let's go as basic as possible. The brain is making meaning in your life mostly through emotional circuits in the brain. In other words, do I have a good life? I don't know. It depends on how you feel about it. Do people respect me? I don't know. How do you feel about it? Do I have enough attention, enough followers, enough time? All of these things are money. All of these things are mediated by how I feel about it, right? We see this, if you really think about it, you can see somebody who makes $100,000, they think they're making a ton of money, and you have plenty of people who think that's not enough money.
Yeah.
You see how this is all mediated by emotion. It's the way I feel that determines the meaning. So I think when people are cut off, you know, you gave a lot of examples from your own childhood. You know, you said you didn't hug your dad until you were 18 years old and you're taught boys don't cry. So the thing you got to think about is, again, there's a very kind of logical consequence of this. So if the child is in, you know, brain development in the early years is utterly magnificent. So it's something like a million neural connections are being built every second in years like 0 to 3. I mean, it's just what happens basically from 0 to 5. Now, what is the one cognitive ability we don't have? Linear language. So at the time our brains are encoding the most information about how to understand reality, we don't have any conscious memory of it because we don't really have these memory stores. We don't have language, things like this. So if I'm getting message after message, and they don't even have to be egregious, although plenty of us got egregious messages. So if I start to cry and my mom says, you better knock it off.
Yeah, I'll give you something to cry about.
Or a lot of times the insult can be much more passive. Yeah. Let's say I start to get fussy and my dad just walks out of the room.
Yeah.
No. Think about the sheer volume of this. Just message after message after message. And if you say like, well, it wasn't direct, I'm not interested in that at all. Most of our interactions are not languaging exactly what we're feeling, but all of this is transacting. Who's powerful? Who's right? When do I get attention? When don't I? How does mom behave? How does dad behave? And I mean, we're talking on the order of millions of data points. So then you grow up as an adult. And I mean, I will hear parents say to their kids just things that can seem as innocuous as this. The kid will say, I'm hungry. And the parent will say, you're not hungry. And what the parent kind of means is like, I saw you just have a snack a little while ago. I don't want to get more food out of the refrigerator. We're going to sit down and eat dinner in 45 minutes. Or how about this? Go tell him you're sorry, but I'm not sorry. Get up right now and go tell him you're sorry. So the parents are giving a lot of signals, even very well-intended parents, that's telling the child to override the emotional GPS of the emotional Google Maps of their life. Do you see this?
Mm-hmm.
So then I start to think, well, I can't trust my feeling. So what do plenty of people do? They put the feeling away. The problem with that is you can suppress it for a while, but you can never outrun it. Most of the people that come to me and to be totally frank with you, I like working with people that are adults because for a long time, you think you can outrun your emotions. You cannot. You can't outrun an energy and a coding that is held inside of your own body. And I see people try to beat it all the time by changing the job or changing the this or changing the relationship. But we go back to how we always feel, because just like you have a physical baseline, you also have an emotional baseline. So if men want to change their relationship with loneliness, it really is these powerful conversations about the power of emotion.
That is one of the more interesting pieces we've probably ever heard on this podcast. Just because I'm, you know, as you're speaking, I'm going through all the different things that I was told, like, swallow that emotion, you know, don't cry. I mean, I probably didn't hug my dad's at 18, but I didn't get a lot of hugs from my mom either. So with my own kids, I have made the concerted effort to hug them as much, not as much as possible, but at least like first thing in the morning, come over, give them a hug. For my son, I try to like pick him up and play with him and smash him and do as much stuff as I can get him to laugh. Because like for the most part, I was a third kid. My parents are real busy. And I felt that like, you know, that was not part of how I was raised. And it was something I always wanted. And so I feel all too often, and this is another thing that kind of fucking drives me crazy, is when people say, well, that's not how I was raised. Mm-hmm. And they just kind of chalk it up. Well, like I wasn't raised like that. Well, I mean, just because, like, did you, you know, or, you know, and you hear this, especially with,
people with like, you know, like violence, you know, like, hey, well, you know, I was beat with a belt. Yeah. But how did that make you feel? And you're okay to keep extending that violence towards your children. You remember that fear of that. So I feel that it's extremely lazy when people just say, well, that's not how I was raised, or, well, that's just how it was when I was that age. And this, you know, and then now you're extending something you didn't like as a kid, or was a fearful or a bad thing. You're just okay to extend that because that's all you know. That feels really lazy and broken to me. When I hear people say that, I'm like, dude, be better. You know, I wanted more hugs when I was a kid. I didn't get a lot. So what do? I want to hug my kids. I don't know if you can hug your kids too much, but I also tell them all the time I love them, you know, especially with my girls, like my little boy. I tell them, I'm like, hey, at the end of the day, you know, your dad loves you. I'm here to take care of you. I'm here to protect you. Like, you know, and I talk to them and arm them all the time. And I'm like, hey, you know, people are going to like you. People aren't going to like you. I'm always here for you, you know, and don't ever do anything that, you know, puts me in a bad situation where I might have to go to jail for the rest of my life. So that's like the joke for us. But I've also found that, especially for women, that if they don't grow up with a positive male role model, and they also, I read a pretty interesting book where it said that, you know, girls will learn how they're supposed to be treated by how their father treats their mom. This was a, you know, I tried to read a bunch of different like books on parenting, especially for daughters, because I grew up with all brothers. And so I thought that was a pretty good one. Like, you know, like a big thing for my wife and I, and my dad was a criminal defense attorney for over 55 years and did like a lot of gnarly murder one stuff. My brother does it. But when my dad was a young attorney, he did some family law. And I asked him about it, and he was like, it was way easier to represent murderers and killers and drug dealers and bad people than it was to do divorces. He's like, those are really ugly. And I asked him once, like, what do you think? Was there anything universal within the divorces that you saw? And, you know, also being married for 55 years, he said, respect. That when things melted to their worst is when the people no longer respected each other or treated each other with respect. He says, as long as you can treat your wife with respect, and she can treat you, and you guys have a respect for each other, you can stay married for a long time. The day that respect goes out, just goes out the window. So that's a big thing I talk about with my wife, and, you know, and especially with my girls and my boys and everybody. Like, you know, you have to be around people that you respect, and people have to respect you. And if they don't, you need to get away from them as quick as possible, because they're not going to treat you well. And you have a responsibility to have people treat you well, and you have to demand it. And I feel all too often people are willing to forego that because they're so nervous that people are going to like them. And so I was like, you know what? People are going to like you. People are going to dislike you. It's just how the world works. You're not everybody likes vanilla. Not everybody likes chocolate. But as long as you know what you want and you demand to be treated well, that's the only marker that you're going to have for your self-respect.
Yes. I think, like, again, that's sort of, I think a lot of people understand that and aspire to arrive at that point, but there's still all this emotional resistance to work through. And well, I think too,
then how do we work through it?
Well, first of all, you read Energy Rising, because it gives you 8 clear steps on how to do this.
Nice.
But, you know, one of the pieces I want to make is that we know that interpersonal pain is worse than physical pain. So if you look at varying types of traumas, we know that interpersonal trauma is, the outcomes of that is worse. I'll tell you a really quick story. So I all of my research has been on, well, my research has been on a lot of things, but my dissertation was on PTSD. And so I was working with a very, very traumatized population. So, and it was all men, and they had, so you go through this checklist when you start the research protocol, and the checklist just says, you basically take them through each criterion for PTSD. So have you ever been beat up? Have you ever been stabbed? Have you ever been shot? It's like, yes, 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 yes. Okay. So a very, very traumatized population. Then at the end, you ask people, what is the, out of all these traumas you endorse, because most people who've experienced trauma don't just have one trauma, they have multiple traumas. Out of all of these traumas that you've experienced, which is the worst? And what was very interesting to me is, and this didn't happen all the time, but it happened enough where it struck me, people would say nothing on that list. The worst thing was my divorce.
Oh. Really?
So what that's sort of telling you is that people have a wealth of very, very traumatizing, I mean, objectively traumatizing things. These are the scientific criteria by which we judge trauma. And they're saying the worst thing that happened to me was my divorce. Now, divorce is not what we consider a PTSD qualifying event. Don't be mad at me about that. The powers that be have kind of said these things can qualify for PTSD. Divorce alone at this stage does not in the DSM. And that's how we, that those are kind of the criteria for all our mental health disorders. But the, who, I mean, they, no one knows their life better than they do. So they're saying it was more excruciating for me to experience this interpersonal rejection, this interpersonal breakdown. And I think, you know, and then if you don't feel like you have options to deal with that, you know, you don't believe in mental health treatment, you don't have a social support system, or worse of all, you've been so busy running from your emotions your entire life that when something happens that's going to invariably force your face and your emotions, you don't have kind of the infrastructure to deal with emotion.
Man, that's yeah, that's powerful. I mean, the you know, anybody, and I hope nobody ever has to go to divorce, but I mean, divorce happens a lot. You know, I mean, you, especially for people that you know, tend to grow apart and whatever, you know, happens. But I don't wish that on anybody. I've never met anybody that ever came out of a divorce and said, "Man, this is the best thing that ever happened to me." And you know, because you know, normally it's not only, I mean, you know, like the, you know, you're in this structure and almost this small team, and it's probably similar to like, you know, getting cut in the NFL, where all of a sudden you have this team, you have a place to go, you have something that you associate with, and then one day they're like, "We don't need you anymore," and they drop you and push you outside and lock the door. It's probably very similar. Yeah, but the PTSD thing is always been fascinating to me, because we work with a lot of like tier one military guys. We work with Naval Special Warfare and the SEALs. Mm-hmm. And
I've worked with much military myself, so I'm very familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so talking with those guys, it's kind of an interesting piece where whenever I talk to them about PTSD, it almost feels like the more training they have, the less instances of PTSD. But also I believe that just those guys are probably extremely intelligent, and they're probably doing a better way of just hiding it, or you know, the training has allowed them to just kind of partition it better. But I mean, how could you not? I mean, people, you know, I thought after my daughter's dog attack, I probably had PTSD because I woke up every morning at 3 a.m. with like, you know, heart palpitations and popped out of bed and couldn't sleep. It took me a few months to finally be able to kind of get through that piece.
Yeah, I mean, you're raising so many interesting points. I actually have this slated until 10, so I can, and I have something at 10:30, so I can do about 10 more minutes. Is that okay?
That is perfect.
Okay, because they put it in my calendar, and I just have to get to another thing, but I've been totally enjoying this conversation. So let me tell you just anecdotally something that I think people will think is really interesting about PTSD. So there's been several times where a veteran would come to see me and they would say, let's say it's Vietnam. I've been back for many, many years. I was fine. I was legitimately fine. I was functioning. I had a good life. And now my wife died. All of a sudden I'm waking up in the middle of the night and I am crouching by my bed looking for the Viet Cong. How could this possibly be happening? Like, this never happened. What happens is we know that frontal parts of the brain, so people, everyone's heard of the frontal lobe. So frontal parts of the brain can downregulate affect. They can downregulate emotion. Does that make sense the way I'm explaining that? So if like I am really afraid of something, I can kind of self-talk and soothe. Okay. We can kind of do that sort of subconsciously too. Well, if there's so much load on the brain, so obviously aging changes the brain, then there's, you know, a big trauma, the loss of, for example, a spouse. What happens then is the ability of the frontal lobe in some cases, and again, I'm just speaking anecdotally, can be compromised enough that all that emotion that was never actually processed, it was handled in a very kind of effective way for many, many years, but that capacity has now been weakened. And so the emotion is still there. One of the things I want people to understand is that until emotion has been, some of us can process and you know, everyone processes in their own way, but emotion, especially painful emotion, if it's trapped inside of the nervous system, just because you're not consciously in touch with it at any given moment does not mean that something's going to happen in the future and not kind of touch on that injury. Right. So emotions are timeless, meaning this is why when people say, "I walked into a room and it was like I remembered the thing from 20 years ago, like it just happened." So things, the way that emotional memories get encoded in our brain, they're held in parts of the brain that don't really understand linear time. This is why you can't remember what you had for breakfast 4 days ago, but you can remember something very clearly that happened to you 40 years ago, right? It's different kind of memory systems in the brain.
It's amazing. When does the book get released? I mean, I know we got an advanced copy and all that. It's coming out, or is it already out?
Oh my gosh, no, it's going to be here in a minute. It's coming out on September 26th. And I think it's really an extraordinary story. So anyone who's interested in becoming more emotionally powerful, understanding how to work with not just their own emotions, but other people's emotions, I think it's a great 8-step roadmap to the neuroscience of emotional power.
I'm excited. You know, we got an advanced copy, went through it. I thought it was amazing. And we get a lot of different people reach out to us with books and to bring on authors and doctors. And I thought it was a very, very powerful book. So thank you for one, for sending it. And two, thank you for the conversation. If people are interested, are social media, is there a website or something?
Absolutely. If people are interested in talking about leadership and emotional power, definitely connect with me. I'm going to be talking about this stuff for a million lifetimes. You can find me, Dr. Julia DeGangi on Instagram, Dr. Julia DeGangi on LinkedIn, YouTube, and Facebook.
Awesome. Well, Doc, thanks for taking time. I know you got to run, but thanks for tuning in. Another episode of Power Athlete Radio.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.